Well, we're in the middle of a storm there in Acts chapter 27. And, you know, years ago, people started doing these little things where they started kind of comparing God to some of the slogans, you know, of products, you know. God is like Allstate. You're in good hands with him. You know all those. You heard those before. God is like General Electric because he brings good things to life. Yeah. I like this one. God is like Tide detergent because he gets out the stains others leave behind. God is like Hallmark cards because he cared enough to send the very best. I like that one. This one's pretty good too. God is like Dial soap. Now you got to be old enough to remember this one. God is like Dial soap. Aren't you glad that you have him? And don't you wish everyone did? But the one I really want to call upon this evening, because it relates to our context in Acts 27, is, and you're going to have to be old enough to remember this slogan too, but God is like VO5 hairspray. He holds in all kinds of weather. And we're going to see that tonight, in the midst of this terrible storm in the Mediterranean Sea, God guarded Paul. He gave him encouragement, and we're going to see he's going to guide him all the way through the storm. Let's get our geography again. This is our journey from here in Caesarea, across, skipping along near Asia Minor, sailed down to Crete. And at Crete, when they tried to make it around to Phoenix, that's when they got caught in the nor'easter that pushed them south. And so they've been fighting this the whole time. And so tonight, we're going to have them arrive here at an island that God put right in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, if for no other reason, to catch this ship and to let Paul speak there. So we were talking last week about dark and stormy night. What do you do when it's a dark and stormy night? And I almost finished that, but not quite. So let's read that again, beginning in verse 27. And we won't go into the detail except one final point I want to make. Acts 27, 27. When the 14th night came, we were drifting in the Adriatic Sea, and about midnight, the sailors thought they were approaching land. They took soundings and found it to be 120 feet deep. When they had sailed a little farther and sounded again, they found it to be 90 feet deep. Then, fearing we might run against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight to come. By the way, just a little historical maritime note here. In the 1960s, divers off the coast of Malta discovered four ancient anchors and didn't even know what they were. They just put them in a maritime museum there in Malta. And only later did archaeologists determine that the location, it was probably these 4 acres from this ship. Verse 30, some sailors tried to escape from the ship. They let down the skiff into the sea, pretending that they were going to put out anchors from the bow. But Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, hey, unless these men stay on the ship, you're not going to be saved. The whole deal is off. Then the soldiers cut the ropes holding the skiff and let it drop. Now, notice there were different groups on this ship. There were sailors. They were the ones escaping. We know how to survive in a storm. This skiff, this lifeboat, has such a narrow draft that we can easily make it on shore, but this ship's not going to make it. So it was the soldiers that cut the ropes and so said to the sailors, no, you can't leave. Verse 33, when it was about daylight, Paul urged them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day that you've been waiting and going without food, having eaten nothing. So I urge you to take some food. For this is for your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head. Now, earlier Paul had said over there in verse 23 and 24 that nobody's going to perish. All 276 are going to live. But here he even says, you know what, you're not even going to get your hair messed up. You're not going to lose a single hair off your head. And then 35, after he said these things and had taken some bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all of them, and after he broke it, he began to eat. And they were all encouraged, and they took food themselves, And all Luke gives us this little detail, there were 276 of us on the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. Now, I was talking to you last week when we finished about how do you survive a dark and stormy night? And I was giving you these things. I gave you five reasons how you can survive a dark and stormy night. Pray and take practical steps, you know. They threw out the anchors, but then they also prayed. Just as they were checking the depth of the water, I said, make sure you check your spiritual depth. And then number three, I said, make sure you take care of yourself physically. I mean, Paul said, hey, you're starving, you're weak. Take care of yourself physically, eat. I said, number four, you know, cut loose your lifeboat. You know, the lifeboat kind of represents our own good deeds, what we think can save us. And we got to realize that nothing that we can do is ever going to save us. We have to trust in God. And then I said, the fifth one, the last one we talked about was go ahead and give thanks for your deliverance. You know, it's one thing to pray for God to help me through this storm. It's another thing, like Paul did, to thank God in front of all the people. So real faith gives you ability to say, God, this is what I've asked for, and I thank you in advance that you're already going to do that. And so that was the fifth thing. But then there was one other thing that I said that will help you survive a dark and stormy night, and that's kind of to lighten up or kind of simplify your life. You know, grain or food on the ship, that's a necessity, right? You think you got to have food, that's a necessity. Well, when you're in the middle of a crisis, when you're in the middle of a storm, those things that you think are necessities, suddenly you find out, you know what, that's not that important. I mean, what's more important, eating or surviving? And so they decided, you know what, we're going to even throw the grain overboard. I've been reading a lot about this because I'm fascinated about it, and I learned a couple of things. First of all, Luke's detailed description of this voyage and especially this shipwreck is one of the most accurate, detailed descriptions of a voyage during this time of history, and ancient mariners' details. And so I've learned that through the years, Acts 27 was studied throughout the world in places where mariners and sailors were taught some of the things they did right, some of the things they did wrong. So his very detailed account gives a help from ancient history. Number two, also, they said one of the reasons that they threw the grain overboard is that, you know what, when grain gets wet, it swells and expands. And so this was not just trying to lighten the ship. This was also, let's get rid of this grain because, you know, if it gets wet, you know, it could actually burst the sides of the ship. There are actually accounts of that happening in ancient ships that were carrying grain. So they just kind of got rid of it. And so I think, folks, whenever you're in the middle of a dark and stormy night, when you're in the middle of a storm, it's good to kind of simplify your life and decide what is most important. And then sort of only focus on that which is most important. And you know, there's something more important than eating, and there's even something more than important than surviving, and that is being faithful to God. You know, I can remember seeing these television shows back when I was a kid. And this guy would come out on stage, and he'd have these poles, and he'd start spinning plates on the poles. Remember that? I mean, and he would get 30 or 40 plates spinning, and then he would have to run to each one and keep those plates spinning all the time. And, you know, that really describes a lot of people's lives these days. I mean, you're involved in so many things. We like to call it multitasking, but you got a lot of plates. You keep them spinning, and it's just kind of wearing you out. And so whenever you're facing a crisis and in the dark and stormy night, just follow this example and go ahead and throw the grain overboard, okay? Simplify your life. Declutter your life. Okay, now we're going to talk about, as we move forward, the shipwreck. This is probably one of the most famous shipwrecks in the world. And when you think about shipwrecks or disasters at sea, probably most people think about the Titanic, right? 1912, the ship that was built, and they said that it's unsinkable. Even God couldn't sink her. And that's about the only thing the Titanic ever did. It just sunk. And then they didn't have enough life boats on board. And so that's something that's changed through the years. But there was another fascinating shipwreck. The largest shipwreck in history in fresh water was on November the 10th, 1975, and the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And if you're old enough like me to remember that song by Gordon Lightfoot, you know, this was a real ship on the Great Lakes there. And part of the lyrics of his song said that when supper time came, the old cook came on deck and said, "Fellas, it's too rough to feed you." At 7 p.m., the main hatchway gave in, and he said, "Fellas, it's been good to know you." The captain wired in, "We have water coming in," and the good ship and crew were in peril. And later that night, the lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. So there have been all kinds of famous shipwrecks through the years, but this shipwreck in Acts 27 is still one of the most famous. But what sets it apart is you hardly ever hear of a major shipwreck without loss of life or without some kind of injury. But the amazing, can we say miraculous thing about this shipwreck is everybody survived. Why? Because God had already promised that. You know, it's like this. God was taking care of Paul because he said, "Paul, I'm going to get you to Rome." And all of these other people, I mean, they were just blessed by God that they happened to be with Paul, right? Because in the process of guarding and saving Paul, God was also guarding and saving the rest of them. So let's pick up here, beginning in verse 27:39. "When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they sighted a bay with a beach, and they planned to run the ship ashore if they could." And so here's the scenario. You know, they've just been driven by the wind for 2 weeks, have no idea where they are, no stars, no sun. Their navigation has been just useless. And so, but they see some land. "Let's make for the shore." So verse 40, "After cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea." And as I said, divers from Malta discovered these four ancient anchors that date back to this time. "At the same time, loosening the ropes that held the rudders, and then they hoisted the foresail to the wind, and they headed for the beach." Now, here's the scene. You know, it's like, all right, here's the beach. You know, we're going to cut the ropes to the anchors, put out this little foresail, cut away the rudders, I mean, and we're just going to let perhaps the wind take us into the shore. What a great example of just being totally out of control. I mean, they didn't have any way to steer the ship. They didn't have any way to stop the ship. They were just at the mercy of the wind driving them toward the beach. Verse 41, "But they struck a sandbar like a reef, and they ran the ship aground. The bow jammed fast and remained immovable while the stern began to break up by the pounding of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that no one could swim away and escape." Now, to me, that's just almost like borders on the ridiculous. You know, your life is at risk, everybody's life at risk, but the soldiers, these Roman soldiers, have been so ingrained in their duty to keep these prisoners that they knew if any of the prisoners escaped, they were going to have to give their lives as a penalty for that. You remember the Philippian jailer, the night there was the earthquake in Philippi, and he was getting ready to fall on his sword because he thought all the prisoners had escaped, and Paul said, no, we're all here. Same thing with these Roman soldiers. All they can think about is we got to kill the prisoners. You know, at least we can say we executed them. But keep reading there. Verse 43, "But the centurion," Julius, we know his name from earlier, "the centurion kept them from carrying out their plans because he wanted," here it is again, "to save Paul." And so he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest were to follow, some on planks, some on debris from the ship. And in this way, circle this word, everyone safely reached the shore. So, I mean, you just have to imagine this scene. This is a scene of a hurricane just continuing to blow and batter the beach, the waves. And the island of Malta has many rocky coasts and steep cliffs. And really, there's only a few places possible where there's even a sandy beach that they could run aground in. And they believe they know where they found that place today in Malta. And so, as you can imagine, there in Malta, this bay is now called St. Paul's Bay. And there's even a church there called the Shipwreck Cathedral. I mean, all of that based on this event. So, you know, we talked about how to survive a dark, stormy night. Well, how do you survive a shipwreck? What happens when your life, how do you survive the shipwrecks of life? You know, people respond to crises in many different ways. You know, one of the first responses that people have is fear. They're just afraid. And of course, these guys were really afraid that they were going to drown and they were going to die. And I think that is probably the first reaction we all display in danger. That's why in the Bible, over and over again, God has to say, do not fear, fear not, don't be afraid. That's exactly what Paul had said over there in verse 24. Look back at verse 24. He said, don't be afraid. God told Paul that, and then Paul told all the people on the ship that, don't be afraid. Other people, when they face problems, they respond in despair, and they say, well, there's no hope. All hope is gone. That really kind of mirrors the action of these sailors. You know what? There's no hope for the ship. It's going to crash. Everybody's going to die. So we're just going to try to save ourselves if we can do that. And so that was a move born of despair. But what we see, of course, in the Apostle Paul is the attitude of trust. God had given Paul his word. I'm going to guard you. I'm going to guide you. I'm going to take care of you. You're going to make it to Rome. And Paul was trusting God. And as a result, what he said would happen, happened. You know, I think there's some lessons that we can learn from that. And the main lesson that we learn from that is that when life seems out of control, just remember, God is in control. When life seems out of control, God is in control. And I think of that ship just sort of being driven by the wind toward this beach, and there's this huge, you know, impact as it crashes there, and then the back of the ship is being broken up, burst by the waves and the wind that just keep pummeling it, and it's just a scene of chaos. It's human chaos. It's life is like the weather. We can't do anything about the weather. There's good days and bad days. But you know what? To God, he's always in control. And we've got to remember that our days are numbered by the Lord. And that when we think life is out of control, he's in control. And there's all different kinds of storms we face. I remember a pastor saying one time that a lady in his church who was bent over with a rheumatoid arthritis was so discouraged and she was so in despair that one day she asked him a hard question. She said, Pastor, tell me why God made me this way. And I think he gave a very wise answer. He said, God isn't finished making you yet. In other words, this is not your final state. This is not the end of you, that God is still in control. And that's what I think we need to remember. Well, now we come actually to the last chapter of Acts. Not the last chapter we're going to study, because we're going to study Acts 29 when we finish Acts 28. But we come now to Acts 28. And the first thing I talk about is a Maltese not a dog, but a Maltese miracle. So let's read about this Maltese miracle beginning in chapter 8, 28, verse 1. Once safely ashore, I love the fact that 27 ends with the term safely ashore. Everybody, and then again, 28, once safely ashore, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The local people showed us extraordinary kindness. They lit a fire and took us all in since it was raining and cold. Now, you know, no matter what the temperature is, you know, if you get wet and you get out of the water and then there's wind, you are going to be, you know, chilly and cold. So the first thing they did was light a fire. As Paul gathered a bundle of brushwood and put it on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened itself on his hand. Well, before we get to the snake, I want you to notice something else about Paul. Here is Paul the apostle. He's the VIP prisoner. He's really the unauthorized leader of the whole group now, because he's the one telling them what to do, what not to do. Well, I love the fact that Paul's out there just gathering firewood like everybody else. He's not sitting there saying, hey, Luke, Aristarchus, would you go get some firewood? You know, some of you soldiers, go over there and get some firewood. No, he's out there doing it himself. I love that, the servant attitude that Paul had. Of course, if you don't like snakes, this next part just kind of gives you the heebie-jeebies a little bit. But Luke, who probably was an expert at a lot of things medically related, uses a word, viper, that means a poisonous snake. Now, we don't know what kind of snake it was, but it was poisonous. And it fastened itself on his hand. You know, there are different ways that snakes strike, and some of them just strike and kind of hit you and then leave. But one of the most poisonous snakes in the world is a coral snake, and it's the one that kind of just latches to you and then whatever that poison is gets into your bloodstream, and it's some of the strongest toxins, you know, in any kind of living animal. So we don't know what it was, but it was one that just hanging there. And so here's Paul. Oh, wow, there's a snake there. And so he just kind of shook it off. Verse 4, it says, when the local people saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to one another, this man no doubt is a murderer. Even though he has escaped the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. It's interesting to me to see their attitude. Their attitude is that of a lot of people today. They think, you know, bad things happen because people are bad, and only good things happen to people who are good. And even though this Paul survived this terrible shipwreck, now he's getting his justice, and now he's going to die from this snake bite. And that's what a lot of people think. You know, he had it coming to him. She had it coming to her. Well, first of all, was Paul a murderer? Well, probably, and for sure he was an accessory to murder, right? We know he was standing there when Stephen was stoned to death, and he probably had other Christians put to death early on. But I love his reaction here. I've kind of already given it away, verse 5. But he shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no harm. You know, I just love kind of picturing that. Oh, wow, there's a snake. Just hold it over the fire and it's going to let go. Sure enough, it let go and burned up the snake. He went on like nothing was wrong. But then it says, verse 6, they expected that he would begin to swell up or suddenly drop dead. And after they waited a long time and saw nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and they said, he's a god. So, you know, that's pretty quick, wouldn't you say? Going from a murderer who's getting what he deserved, getting bit by a poisonous snake, to now he is a god. You know, there's a passage over there in Mark 16, the last part of Mark 16, where Jesus is recorded as saying, you know, that these signs shall follow them who are my disciples. And it says over there that they will pick up poisonous snakes and they won't die, you know. And we've talked about this before, but there are some small groups of Christians in West Virginia and East Tennessee and East Kentucky, that's part of their worship service. They handle snakes. You know, they have boxes of rattlesnakes and coral heads there, copperheads there in the church in boxes. And at a certain time in church, they open the boxes and, you know, they start dancing around. You can see it on YouTube. It's pretty freaky looking, you know, scary looking. And they'll handle those snakes during the worship service. And I know somebody asked me one time, they said, Pastor, what do you think about those snake handlers? I said, I think a lot of them are dead. Because it is true, there are cases of people dying, you know, when they're handling the snakes. And you know what the attitude of the poor people in those churches are? Well, they just didn't have enough faith. You know, almost the attitude of these natives on this island, you know, he's going to die from this snake bite because he's done something wrong. And maybe this guy or this girl that died of the snake bite in the church, she just done something wrong or didn't have enough faith or something like that. All I want to say is that when Jesus talked about the ability to be bitten by a snake and survive, he wasn't talking about tempting God and picking up snakes in a worship service. I think this is the perfect example of what he was talking about. That while you are serving God and you're in the middle of God's will, and when God isn't finished with you yet, you are totally indestructible until God finishes with you. Paul had already been assured by God, you're going to go to Rome. And so even though there's a poisonous snake, even though there's a hurricane, even though there's a shipwreck, you know, he was not going to die that way, because God said, I'm not through with you yet. So I think that is the fulfillment of what Jesus was talking about in Mark chapter 16. So after the Maltese miracle, then we see what I call the Maltese ministry. So let's pick up there in verse 7. Now in the area around that place was an estate belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. Publius's father was in bed suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went to him and praying and laying his hands on him, he healed him. And after this, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and they were healed. And so they heaped many honors on us, and when we sailed, they gave us what we needed. Now, verse 11, we see that they're going to be there for 3 months. And even though it doesn't say this, we know that wherever Paul went, what did he do? He preached Jesus Christ. And there are always these groups of miracles that always almost appear where the gospel is preached for the first time. God sort of it reinforces the preaching of the gospel with signs and wonders. And so it started with this official's father. He healed him. And then all the sick people come and they're also healed. And when it says in verse 10 that they gave many honors on us, it's the word we get our word honorarium from, which means they actually paid Paul and the people on the ship for their ministry there. And I think we need to always remember that there's more to the ministry than just preaching and just teaching about the Word of God. We also need to minister to the physical needs of people, whatever it may be. And that's what we see Paul doing there. So then verse 11, finally we come to this final stretch here. After 3 months, we set sail in an Alexandrian ship that had wintered in the island with the twin gods as its figurehead. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed 3 days, and from there making a circuit along the coast, we reached Rhegium. After 1 day, a south wind sprang up, and the second day we came to Puteoli. This is where they're going to make port. Now, let's go back to Malta for just a minute as we finish tonight. The interesting thing to me is that, you know, this is apparently when Paul was shipwrecked there, this is a place where the gospel had not reached yet. You know, he preached at Crete, he preached at many other places, but these folks are obviously pagans. Because first of all, they said he's going to die, got bit by a snake. And then number two, he's a god. And you might be interested to know that today, and this has been true ever since the first century, Malta has had one of the strongest Christian communities in the entire world to this day. And to this day, 98% of the people in Malta identify themselves as Christians. So I think you think, well, you know, God just put that island there to catch Paul's ship. Well, I think God directed that ship there and Paul there so he could preach the gospel to them, so that today, many, many generations later, this island would be filled almost to capacity with followers of Jesus Christ. Just lets us know, folks, God knows what he's doing. He's in charge of everything. When we think it's out of control, he's in control. We'll pick up here next week.